All right, thank you. I'm sure that all of us here would agree with me in feeling that we've been greatly blessed by Justine's talks yesterday and Ken's this morning as well, as he's kind of, again, just put that all in the bigger picture of the bigger story of Jesus. What I'd like to do today is to kind of just add to that dialogue, add to that message that Justine was giving yesterday, and to talk about the role that technology is having in shaping the I-world thinking, the I-world story. Justine spoke about change. She talked about, as Ken has reminded us today, about the T-world and its change towards the I-world. Well, she also used this great metaphor, this great image of it used to be more like a river with its bounds, with its banks, And it's got a certain direction that it's flowing along, and we are in that river. We've got the boundaries, and when there's a current or a flow or a story that's pushing us along and shaping us, and we're in together and we move together in that. And she says we're heading more towards what's like an ocean. Do you remember that metaphor? And the ocean is like, well, we can go left or right, up, down. There's no bounds. There's no limits. And in the absence of that, the absence of a story or current or flow that we're moving along, we have to actually invent one. And what we're tending to do is invent one that's all about us. And that's the movement towards the T world to the I world. And what I'd like to do is to show how technology, and that's important for us to think about, because in the educational landscape, technology is playing a more and more crucial role. And we need to be, as Christian educators, as NTCSA, we need to be thinking critically about that. Not to be saying no to technology, but to be exploring ways in which we can think discerningly about its use so that we can actually speak into the shaping effects that the technology is having as we head towards an I world, an ocean of possibilities. Can I start by telling you a little bit of a story? Two quite pivotal things happened for me on Friday the 2nd of March 2012. And those two things are, well, first of all, Warragamba Dam overflowed its banks. Big deal, you might say. Well, actually, in Sydney, it was a little bit of a big deal because it hadn't got full for 14 years. So it was the first time in 14 years that it actually overflowed its banks. In the week leading up to that, it was on a Friday, I had a friend who was sending me emails all the time, giving me updates on the dam levels. And he kind of got me into it. And I was sort of starting to track the dam levels myself. And looking forward to his emails telling me it's now at 94%, it's now at 96.7%. I started to think, well, actually, the National Office is quite near Warragamba Dam, so I started to think, I might be able to go and watch it overflow. This is cool. I started to do a Google search and I couldn't find any information, latest information that was tracked. And I emailed him back and said, how are you finding these statistics out about the dam wall? And he said to me, hash Warragamba is my friend. But hash Warragamba, Twitter, you're familiar with Twitter, hash is a way of, if you put a hash in front of a word or a phrase, then that allows Twitter to aggregate or sort of group together all tweets that have that hashtag in it. So he was following that. So the second really important thing, crucial, pivotal thing that happened to me on the 2nd of March was I made my first tweet. Let me tell you a little bit about that. As I got to the dam wall, actually, as it got closer to the time it was about to overflow, I called my wife and said, well, bring the kids down. It was looking like it was going to overflow at about 6:30 in the evening. So bring the kids down, we'll go and we'll watch that overflow. And we made a little bit of a thing about it. When I was walking back from the observation platform, having taken some photos, I had this overwhelming desire to tell people about it, not just the people I was with and to talk with them at the observation platform, but to tell people wider about it, to actually broadcast the fact that I'd just seen it and to share photos that I was there. And I sat in the car after I walked back and I went, what was going on for me to have that sense of feeling? Would I have had that feeling 15 years ago in a similar context? this desire to share to everybody, it got me thinking about how these technologies are actually shaping our thinking, shaping the way we think about our place in the world and thinking about our contributions to the world and thinking about our perspectives of ourselves. And I'd like to just explore that a little bit with you today. Because I'd like to suggest that our digital technologies are actually changing our view, just as Justine was saying yesterday. She had a great analysis of the cultural understandings of that. I'd like to just look at how that the technologies in themselves are actually shaping this view of life, the view of others, and the view of our world that we live in. In fact, these technologies are shaping our view of the good life that God has designed for us. So the question really is, how are we going to help our young people to navigate through this new world, the iWorld, the ocean with no boundaries, the ocean with limitless possibilities? How are we going to help our young people to navigate through that? Because we know that our teenagers, particularly our teenagers, are completely connected to these technologies. They all have their PlayStations and their iPods and their iPads and their computers and their internet connections. Now, I know we had a discussion yesterday about kids in remote places, but our kids in remote places are tending to have their mobile phones still. And more so, they are smartphones with connections to the internet as well. So we need to be thinking about that, digital natives. But we have to also start thinking about our tweens as well, don't we? I actually heard a kindergarten teacher saying the other day that they had 4 or 5 children in their class that had mobile phones as well. And these were smartphones with connections to the internet with HD video on them, iPods on them so they could have 2,000 songs on there as well. But where does it stop? And of course, all these technologies are now connecting, even if it's a PlayStation, there's a connection to the internet with it as well. So they're all connected in this one big giant network as well. Okay, some themes. I want to start by talking about our addiction to information and how technology has actually shaped that and caused that to happen. You remember this adage? This adage goes, "To a man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail." I've actually been a woodwork teacher. I know that for, say, you 9 boys. Literally every single thing, even their fellow students, can sometimes look like a nail when they have a hammer in their hand. But the point of that is true. Is a hammer simply a piece of technology? It's a tool that we choose to either use wisely or unwisely. Or does the actual hammer have a shaping effect when we find it in our hands? And that's the question we want to explore today. Neil Postman, in his book Technopoly, and I highly recommend this book to you, he said this. In the year 1500, 50 years after the printing press was invented, we did not have old Europe plus the printing press. We had a different Europe. After television, the United States was not America plus television. Television gave us a new coloration to every political campaign, to every home, to every school, to every church, to every industry. The world had changed. The technology had actually changed culture. It had changed the story in which, the river in which society was moving through. Let's just wind ourselves back a little bit to the invention of this technology. Anyone, what is it? The Morse code, so this is the Morse key. It's the technology that was either end of the telegraph, a network of wires that joined the cities initially in America. What the telegraph did, and if I could use the adage that we talked about before, to a man with a telegraph, all information suddenly was seen as good. So previously, crimes that happened overnight in Los Angeles were never known about in, say, Chicago. But suddenly, with the invention of the telegraph, see, prior to this, information could only travel as fast as a human could travel it, if that's a word. So on a train, maybe, or on a horse, really fast horse. But now we could have information travelled lots of places fairly instantly. And see, crime statistics from Chicago were now transmitted the next morning to Los Angeles, and it created a notion, the existence of technology created the notion that that information was actually good. Now, it may or may not have been, but the point is the mentality, a thinking was created at that point. Postman goes on to say this: the telegraph may have made the country into one neighbourhood, but it was a peculiar one, populated by strangers who knew nothing but the most superficial facts about each other. And if I could actually reword that to say, and even more so, the internet may have made the world into one neighbourhood, but it's a peculiar one populated by strangers who know nothing but the most superficial facts about each other. And Ken said something very similar to what Tim Keller has said this morning, and that is that idolatry is when we take a good thing and we make it an ultimate thing. And I'm going to suggest to you that these technologies are pushing us towards taking information, which is a good thing, it's good to be informed, and making it an ultimate thing. And I love it when I learn that I'm reading similar books to Ken. Ken quoted Quinton Schultz this morning. And Quinton Schultz says this: we are succumbing to informationism, a non-discerning, vacuous faith in the collection and dissemination of information as a route to social progress and personal happiness. You see, we're heading towards more focusing on knowledge about things rather than knowledge of things. You see the difference? It's a much more shallow understanding. He also goes on to say this: as the pool of information grows, our actual knowing declines. Does that have some resonance with you? And I love this quote. He says, reading online about the needs of the world, for instance, is never the same as personally knowing people in need. And I found this little cartoon. If you can't read that, it's a man with all sorts of technology on him, including a computer and a satellite dish, and the title is The Information Age. But the caption is, no, I have no idea where your next meal is coming from, he says to a third world person. We have become informational voyeurs of life rather than responsible participants in the knowing of our own cultures and communities. You see, we have made access to information actually more important. We've made it an idol, more important than actually knowing or understanding. I found this poster recently, I quite like it. It's blogging. Never before have so many people with so little to say said so much to so few. And there's a person sitting on the edge of a cliff on their laptop blogging about it. And I like this quote from Tim Chalice, that information is a great servant, but it's a lousy master. What this is causing is, and meaning is, that we are losing our ability to discern with all this information that we're swimming in, losing the ability to discern what is valuable and what is valueless. Are you finding that, those of you that work as teachers with the kids, are you finding that with your students? They're losing that ability to discern because context is being reduced. All the time, our context for our information is becoming more and more decreased. A Christian philosopher, Albert Borgman, helpfully says this. He says, in observing what change is happening towards the eye world, he's saying, we're seeing a replacement of wonder and dazzle. We're seeing the replacement of wonder with dazzle and this is the point I want to focus on, of communication with decontextualized information. Knowing has become trivialized. And I think knowing is becoming demoted. What do I mean by that? Let me show you with a diagram. If we say we can start with just mere facts about things, data, if you like, if we start to collect that data together, we can get some information on something. But the more that information we collect that together and we process that, we put it into its context and we seek to understand it, then we can develop knowledge. But we can actually go further too, can't we? Knowledge can actually be a stepping stone to wisdom. But what I'm suggesting is that the more the technologies that we have increase our ability to handle data and information, and that's what all these communication and information technologies do, then what is happening is that we're heading back down this continuum and we're spending our time focusing on data and information, and we're not taking those extra steps towards knowledge, true knowing, and ultimately towards wisdom. Because it would seem that this collection of information, the collecting of it, seems to have become an end in itself. But we know that accumulation of information does not actually equal wisdom. We know that that's part of our story. That's part of the story that we must be telling our kids, telling our young people. Found this picture. I wonder what this picture makes you feel. I wonder what ideas come to your mind when you see this picture. I wonder what feelings you have. Could you actually turn to the person next to you right now while I take a drink and tell them just what comes to mind here, ideas or feelings about what this picture creates for you? Okay, I found this quote recently, and you actually can see this quote in a number of places on the internet. I can't verify it, nobody can, but it's probably true. It says this: a person is now subject to more information in a day than a person in the Middle Ages had access to in their entire life. It is probably true, isn't it? If you think about all the movies, video clips, magazines, TV, movies, social networking and so forth, tweeting, it probably is true. We have now reached a point where our lives are log-jammed with junk data. I don't just mean the illegal spam, but the time-robbing, nourishment-free information that we lay on each other every day. And that might be a particularly cynical analysis of it, but there's got to be some truth there, I'm sure. And a quote from T.S. Eliot back in 1934 from The Rock, he said, "Where is the wisdom that we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we have lost in information?" Just to remind you again that accumulation of information does not equal wisdom. Another aspect that these technologies are responsible for in shaping our view of life is our understanding of truth and where we find truth and how truth, authority in truth, is created. The source of truth. Because if we look at some technologies like, say, what's this? Wikipedia, thank you, or even Google. The simple existence of these technologies and the availability, particularly to our young people, means that it's shaping their view of where authority is to be found. What do I mean? Well, Wikipedia, you know, it's the idea that the community of users actually create the data, create the knowledge base, if you like, the encyclopedia. So previously, back in a T-world sort of context, we would have said that authority on some particular thing, fungus, particular type of fungus in the Northern Territory, there would be a body of experts that would have spent their time researching that, would have spent their time doing research, they would peer-reviewed, they would have written and so forth. And we would call on that. But now, we see that we would turn to the community at large to have all contributed and reviewed each other and come up with the current consensus on that view. So you can see that's quite a shift. Now, there was good elements and bad elements of that, and there's perhaps some good and bad to find here, but can you see in the mentality that the worldview of young people now is they see that, well, truth can be found in consensus. Google. Do you know when a student will do a young person will do a search, the ranking at which those items come up, they'll actually place an indication of their belief in the authority of those things based on where they hit, where they come up in the search list. And if we probably were honest with ourselves, we might tend to do that sometimes as well. But the truth is that Google, the algorithms and the formulas they use to develop the ranking, have lots and lots of ulterior aspects going on, ulterior motives. Some of them are quite commercially oriented and so forth. Don't have time to explore that too much more. Shirky says, I think quite helpfully, it's not information overload, it's actually filter failure. And Tim Shillee's in a great book, which I highly recommend. If you want to do any more reading and exploring on this particular topic, get the book called The Next Story. And Tim Shillee's in that book says this: what is truth? It is genuine, it is real, it is pure, it is what God thinks. Do you want to know what is true about anything? Well, find out what God thinks about it and think the same thing. That is truth. Now, another aspect of how this technology is shaping our view of things, shaping the eye world, is that we need to recognize that we live in a highly mediated world. Our young people live highly mediated lives. Mediated, what do I mean? I mean there is something going between them and some aspect of life. A mediator is someone who goes between. Media is something that goes between a person and some aspect of the world. So I'm suggesting that they live highly technologically mediated lives. Some form of technology is going in between them and some aspect of God's world. They are, in fact, the most mediated generation ever to exist. And this is a helpful quote from Buckingham. As early as 1960s, it was apparent that children were spending more time watching television than they were in school. And while with the advent of other screen-based media, children's television viewing has slightly declined in recent years, the overall picture is clear. Children spend more time with media of various kinds than they do on any other activity apart from sleeping. That's got to be eye-opening for us, doesn't it, if that is true? No other activity apart from sleeping. And think about the storytelling. We've actually said, and there was a great presentation yesterday about the NTCSA narrative, meta-narrative. If we want our kids to be grasping that meta-narrative, we also have to realise that they are actually swimming in a world where they are absorbed into these technologies more than anything else apart from sleeping. We'll need to be speaking into that with that meta-narrative, with that story. An example of this, it's the kind of classic example, and Justine did a great example, time yesterday with us, talking us through the effects of Facebook. But it's an example of a technology that's mediating between them and some aspect of the real world, in this case, relationships. So the technology is an interface between them. Powers says this: why not flee from the... This is his view of how people think in the eye world. Why not flee from the few of the living room for the many of the screen, where all relationships are flattened into one user-friendly mosaic, a human collage that's endlessly clickable and never demands our full attention. And isn't that true? We may have hundreds of friends on Facebook, but they never really demand our full attention, do they? Now, we'll abort mission on that. That's fine. It was a commercial from Thailand. It was actually a commercial from a telecommunications company, which is interesting. But what it shows is a number of people doing things on their phone. They're connected to their phone. They're doing stuff on there. And other things are happening around them. But in the video, those people become kind of invisible, but they're still doing their thing. There's a pencil writing on the coffee table next to the bloke who's sitting on the lounge doing his thing on his phone. But then suddenly, in the movie, he kind of stops and he sees the pencil moving and he has a change of heart, change of mind, and suddenly his daughter comes into full vision and they smile and they laugh together, and then all of the other people realise they put their phones back in their pockets. Okay, it's kind of a bit of sentimentalising, but I think it actually was speaking into something. And if you actually do a Google search for disconnected to connect, you'll find lots and lots of people talking, lots of resources, lots of ideas about that topic. And I think it's a helpful one. I'm switching everything over to the internet, my phone, my bills, my human contact. What about YouTube then? We've talked about Facebook. YouTube is actually having, by its very existence, having a shaping effect as well. And I think it's shaping our view of what is virtuous character, particularly in the notion of humility. Justine spoke about this at length yesterday in terms of Facebook, but YouTube as well. The idea of a vlog, not a vlog is, you know, blog, people keep a blog, which is a kind of weblog, a diary online. There's many people, young people, that keep a vlog, which is a video diary online. They'll actually speak to camera and they'll do that regularly and post it on YouTube. And there's people that have lots and lots of followers doing this. And let me just, I'll come back to that in a second. So you've got all these young people talking to camera. And Justine talked yesterday about them grooming their sort of appearance and the settings and everything to kind of shape that. You'll find heaps of YouTube videos that are just like this. Now, I'm suggesting that the existence of YouTube is actually shaping in them a mindset about being out there, about being narcissistic, about presenting themselves in a way. Let me go back to this and let me share with you some research that's been done in this. It's San Diego University, a longitudinal study, where they surveyed 16,000 students over the years 82 to 2006, and they measured the narcissistic personality inventory. And what they found was that there was a 30% increase over those years in the narcissistic personality inventory. And in the report, they talk about gadgets and online social networking sites have actually stoked the self-loving tendencies of modern humans. I think that's helpful, the way they've expressed that, because there's always a tendency for us to want to be self-loving. That's certainly been the case since the fall. But these technologies, these gadgets and online social networking has actually stoked that tendency to the point where I believe it's become virtuous to be narcissistic. People were embarrassed about narcissism before, but now young people are becoming they're swimming in a world where it's actually virtuous, a good thing to be narcissistic. I found this T-shirt recently. I'll just zoom in on that for you. If you combine narcissism and stalking, you get Facebook. If you combine narcissism and ADHD, you get MySpace. Put them all together and you get Twitter. Thought that was quite insightful. Justine spoke a lot about the makeover mentality that these technologies are also creating. Think about the role that technology has played in that as well. Wind back before the social networking phenomenon and just go back to the ability that we have with digital graphics to try and to airbrush, to actually create these perfect presentations of humans, and how that has shaped our view of ourselves and our own self-identities and our own anxieties around that. Then wind that forward into social networking and everything that Justine said as well, that whole makeover culture. But this graphic, which is actually a cover of a book that Justine referred to yesterday, Generation Me, the picture sums up so much. The whole idea of tattoos and body sculpting in terms of piercings and so forth, the whole idea of presenting lots of flesh in a very sexualized way, the sassy sort of sexualized stance, and of course there's a phone in the pocket as well. Actually, if you can see, there's a headphone connecting them as well. Because Shelley's, in his book, The Next Story, says many of us are more concerned with who we are in a mediated context, our mediated selves, than we are who we are before those who live in the same neighbourhood or attend the same church. Ever been to the Facebook page of one of your students and you see the image that they portray there of themselves, and you look and you know this person from class, but then you look at this and you think that, one, they look 10 years older, the way that they've actually groomed themselves and they've set the photograph up and so forth, and you just think, I don't kind of recognise them at all. It's a very different presentation. They spend time crafting that. It's part of the eye world journey that they're on. Our young people live in the most mediated generation ever to exist. What's happening in this mediated world? Well, if we think we're heading from unmediated intimacy towards a completely mediated life, just for the point of argument, let's explore what happens as we move along that continuum. What we'll actually find is a couple of observations. we are gaining a greater dependency on that media. If we're moving towards an identity that's much more created by our mediated selves, then we'll have a much greater dependency upon these technologies to understand and define who we are. It's also creating a sense of relational laziness as we head along this path too. If all of our relating, our networking and friendships, our community is mediated through some technology, we're actually developing a relational laziness. And we are putting much more emphasis on our mediated self-identity than we do our real, authentic, embodied identity. No, I'm not talking about Twitter. I literally want you to follow me. Yes, there are benefits to be found in these technologies. Let's not, and Ken, that was really helpful explaining that this morning too. There are great benefits to find in these technologies. But as we explore those benefits, we must make sure that we stay committed to unmediated intimacy in relationships. That's part of our design, to live in unmediated intimacy and relationships with others. And let's seek to always be looking to avoid the distancing effects. As we embrace these technologies, look for the distancing effects and avoid them. Now, Albert Borgman, again, in his device paradigm, he describes an increasing disengagement from life as fabrics of intimacy are being lost. And I like this phrase, there is a move out of reality into the bluff and an illusion of a virtual reality. People are removed from the thick world of context, he goes on to say. All right, another aspect that we'll just explore. Some people argue that these technologies are creating greater community. Here's a map of Facebook connections shown as a kind of distribution map across the world. So these technologies increase community. Well, yes, maybe, but it's a very particular type of community that it creates. It's a community that's much more about shared interests than it is about shared space. In fact, and right back from the early days of the use groups and the forums on the internet, on the World Wide Web, we're seeing that a narrowing down of what these communities are involved with. So you get like-minded people becoming more like-minded together, and that becomes community. It's about shared interests much more than about sharing lives together, about sharing space, about sharing our lives with people that may actually have different interests, may actually have some different views, some different backgrounds to us. Now, here is a picture of my first attempt at making a musical instrument. Last year, I made a little ukulele. And I didn't have a book, I didn't have any plans, I didn't go to a class. I entirely used forums and YouTube videos. And I was able to make... So, there's good things. It's an example of me saying that there is good creational essence to be found in these things, but we need to be careful. If I for a minute think that my involvement in the forums, the ukulele making forums that I'm now a part of, if I for a minute think that that's authentic community for me in my life, I need to rethink that. Wellman really helpfully sums this up by saying it's online community, well, that actually really equals networked individualism. LearnToDance.com. Right click, left click, right, left click, and so forth. So what? What have I said? What am I saying? How does all this fit in? How do we understand this? We understand this, and we need to understand this, because it's crucial for us to help our young people to navigate through. They're swimming in this big ocean. They don't have the boundaries of the river so much anymore. They don't have a story that's pushing them along in the river so much anymore. We need to help them. We need to provide for them a way of navigating through life. And there really is only one true story that we ought to be shaping and sharing with our kids, and that is the true story of the Lord Jesus. In fact, It's the true story that the meta-narrative of NTCSA that was presented yesterday so helpfully explains to us. God loves me. I am God's person. I am restored by grace. I'm living in God's place, living under God's rule, doing justice, loving mercy, walking humbly with him, a disciple of Jesus. Therefore, I seek to restore. That's the story that we need to be telling our kids, is the true story of life. So if we explore that a little bit further and say, the biblical view of God's place that our young people are in, that you are in, we need to be telling them that they are living in. The biblical view of God's place is one that says that, this world, God's place, is good. When God had made it, he stood back and he said, it is good. So yes, that means panda bears and tropical islands. Yes, they're good, sure. But it surely also means things like family. We didn't invent the notion of family. That's part of God's good design in his good world that he's given us. Justice, it's a good thing. Storytelling through the arts, through theatre and through music and so forth, it's a good thing. Humour, unself-conscious, humorous interchange between two people. Surely that's God's creational influence there, and it's a good thing as part of his world. Competition. I'm apparently having a competition with Jeff today at lunchtime to beat him at table tennis.
You will not.
Ooh, okay. Competition used rightly is a good thing. Governance, leadership, dare I say it, is actually a good thing. You can quite see who those people are. Learning is a good thing. These are the good aspects of this good world that God has given us to live in. Technology, indeed, is a good thing. Apparently, I was talking to a friend of mine, showing him this picture the other day. I just picked it because it was a really cool-looking piece of technology. Maybe for the ladies in the room, they're going, yeah. The blokes are going, oh, what is that? He said it's the camera that they're using to film The Hobbit at the moment. It's the best camera in the entire world. Oh, okay, cool. Now, just because there are some distortions in God's good world, so just because prostitution exists or pornography exists doesn't make sex bad, for example. Or money, for instance, same deal. The idea of something that you can trade for other things in its essence is not a bad thing. Or the printing press, even though the printing press, one of our first information and communication technologies, one of the first things that it printed was Catholic indulgences. That doesn't make it a bad thing in and of itself. Or even the internet. Sure, there are problems with the internet, if you can see that picture probably. It captures that really well. But it doesn't make it bad and wrong in and of itself. But we need to see that it has a shaping influence. So the story then, we could sum it also up by saying that God has created the world. If the world is distorted, but there is good creational essence there. And we can be a part of the redeeming that's going on. That God is unfolding this massive redemption project through Christ, and we can be a part of that as we head towards the new creation. So then, if that's the case, we think of technology again and we say, well, actually, it's a good creational gift, isn't it? It's a blessing. But it's a blessing that's kind of like this gift. This blessing. Can you see that? Yes, it's a gift, but it has a hidden army of subtle seduction hiding within it. John Van Dyke says this about Christian education. He says, quality Christian education, in short, enables our children to continue their life's journey with ears attuned to the story, capital S story. To achieve this momentous task, Christian schools continuously need to ask fundamental questions about life, about our culture, and the spirits that roam about uttering derailing voices. Christian schools search the nooks and crannies of the garden, the good creation, to see what's happening and what has gone wrong, where the distortions are, and how to heal and restore. These derailing voices, some of these derailing voices that we've been exploring today, challenge our young people to be thinking along the lines of, what is knowing? Can I really know? What is authentic relationship? What is it to have virtuous character? Where is the source of authority to be found? What is true community? And how valuable is unmediated living? These are the questions, the shaping forces that these technologies are giving us. They're really summed up by saying, where is the good life to be found? Good life that God has made for us. Because in fact, I think the greatest potential danger of our digital technologies are not so much the identity theft issues, the stalking issues, the cyberbullying type issues. I think that the shaping effects that they have, shaping our young people's view of the world, shaping their view of others, shaping their view of themselves, shaping their view of what the good life is, I think is far more dangerous, because it's far more subtle. Now, this is a really big job. Now, of course, your job, those of you working with NTCSA, and that is to be seeing the students involved and the families involved captivated by the gospel of the Lord Jesus. There's no doubt about that. But our job is also to be teaching discernment, teaching that there are shaping influences, other stories being told, and they're being told through the sheer existence of our technologies. Is this just keynote rhetoric? Have you heard keynotes before where you've just gone, yeah, that's all very well and good, but what does that mean for me on the ground? What does that mean for me back in my family group home? What does that mean for me back in the classroom? Well, I hope that that today is not going to be that for you. I'd like to give you what I'm going to suggest are my technology tips. Now, the nickname of mine is Toff, and because I'm a teacher, I love alliteration. So I've gone for Toff's technology tips, and here they are. There's five. Are we ready for the first one? Can I have a drum roll, please? Thank you. The first one is, teach your young people, those in your care, to know rather than just to seek to know rather than just be informed. To allow knowing to then lead them to wisdom. Now, I don't know how that works for you in your context, but think about ways in which you can be, even with your own children, having them seek to know rather than just be informed, which they will have a tendency to do because of the I world story that they are swimming and living in. Second one, be careful, teach your young people, to be careful with informational consensus. A large number of people can collectively agree on folly. Be careful with informational consensus. Number three. Realize, teach your young people, to realize that even though technology suggests it, the world doesn't revolve around them. Now, it's important to realize that they will think it does simply because they're swimming in a world where the technologies are actually shaping that story, that view. But help them to realize that even though it suggests that, it doesn't actually revolve around them. Four, embrace authentic community. Teach your young folk to embrace authentic community. Don't settle for networked individualism, which again, they will have a tendency to do because that's their world. Number five, teach your young people to engage with God's real world rather than mediated versions of it. Now, I'll put all five of them up. Not sure how well you can see that. We've got a couple of minutes, and what I would like you to do now is to turn to the person near you, maybe twos, maybe threes, and you get a chance now to talk with that person about your context and how you might be able to do this. You might be able to take just one of these and say, oh, I think I can, with my kids in my family home, I could do this that will help them to understand one of those aspects. Or maybe you're a teacher and you might want to have a chat with the other person about, yeah, I think I could develop a poster for my classroom that highlights some of these or one of these things, and I could have it look like this or say this. You've got about 5 minutes just to turn, chat with the person, people near you. Go for it. All right, ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests. All right, just we'll come back together. You can finish some of those discussions at morning tea, perhaps. Can we just do a little bit of summing up then? Let's sum up what we've kind of been saying. So a conclusion. I've kind of been saying two things. On one hand, I'm saying there's great creational essence to be found in these things. It's a blessing that God has given us that we can innovate and use technologies to help us. And we should enjoy that as a blessing from God. But on the other hand, I've been saying, we do need to realise the shaping effects that these technologies are having. And we need to help those that are in our informational care, our young people, to discern when and how they are being shaped. We need to show them that there is another story. We need to show them that although this story that they are living in, the iWorld story, is really strong, and they may not even realize it's so strong, they're like the fish swimming in the water that doesn't know anything else other than that. But we need to tell them there's another story, and that's the meta story, the story of God's good world and how he has come to save that world through his son Jesus. Now let's continue this conversation. There's my email address if you want to actually talk with me about that in that way, in any way. SEPA, there's lots of really good discussion goes on the ICT Integrators Forum in SEPA that talks about this issue as well. And I'll leave this cartoon with you that talks about change. Thanks, Jeff.